You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maude, and this is episode 007. Today I'm talking with Lisa Brennan-Jobs, the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Small Fry. It's a beautiful, delicate portrait of the struggle one sometimes has with the fuzziness of family, especially the fuzziness around blood. Who's in or out? Who is true family or false family? Even though the book is mainly about the self-actualization of a young girl, it resonated with me at a very fundamental level. Personally, as an adopted person, I've spent my whole life grappling with where and how those lines of family are drawn, and how they can shift unexpectedly, sometimes beneath your feet, in truly tragic ways. There's a tenuousness to life when blood doesn't explicitly bind you to anyone. Small Fry digs into these sorts of thorny issues. It just so happens that Lisa's dad was Steve Jobs, so there's this kind of added surrealist element to her exploration. It also turns out that the book has a killer cover, and so Lisa and I dive into how the cover and design of the book came to be, how she ended up choosing her publisher, and what the writing and publishing process felt like. Here's today's episode. Good morning, Lisa. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start on the outside of the book and kind of work our way around it before going into it. First of all, it's just beautiful. It's just a gorgeous book.
Thank you.
Book.
That's high praise coming from you.
Well, it really is. It's striking. It's got all of these kind of qualities of what I think make beautiful covers beautiful. So it's wonderful typography. I think you're using Hera Big on the cover there.
That's right. And it's a new font. And I was actually kind of worried about it because it's not very chic in a certain way. It's not very modern. I guess it's not like italic Helvetica bold.
Yeah, no, it's definitely
And already I was dealing with a major exposure of myself in the work. And so I was hoping that there would be something about the cover that would be unassailably fine, ordinary, normal, or something like that. And I worried about this Hera a lot, actually.
Because you thought it was cut of a too contemporary cloth, or?
Yeah, and I was worried that it was based on an old font, but that perhaps it hadn't yet stood the test of time and it might not have the same refinement. And did it have extra on it? What were those balls? And what were those sort of dangly dongly things? And the one thing that I knew I wanted to do was have a large title, because I was already naming my book a diminutive.
Right.
Small Fry means insignificant as well. And so I thought, I can't name my book small and then have the title also quite small. Because like, what am I doing? Trying to disappear? So I wanted that to be big for contrast. But then I also just wanted it to be kind of stylish. And I worried that the Hera Big and my name were different fonts, that there was a serifed font and a sans serif font. And I think that actually one of the things that put my worries more to rest was that when we adjusted the kerning of the title, then somehow, you know how kerning is, like, I personally, you probably can do it yourself, but I wouldn't know how to do it, but I can tell when it's done. And when it's done, it feels like an eyeball massage.
Right. It's fixed now.
That's
thing
good.
That,
yes.
I didn't even know what was wrong, but it feels good.
Yeah. Now I will feel acceptable when this is out there in the world.
Yeah. Well, you worked with designer Allison Forner on this.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a great collection of work behind her as well.
She does. And I liked the fact that it seemed like on the masculine feminine balance, it didn't seem like it was either one particularly. And I also liked the way that she seemed to be comfortable playing with fonts and incorporating them quite well into her designs.
Right, right. That Small Fry font, the Hera, to me, I think it feels perfect for the book, because it's sort of vibrating in this weird space.
Exactly.
Your book looks like it came from like 1978, you know,
right.
Like it really feels like something that came out of a different era, like, you know, a different, like Bonfire of the Vanities could have had, you know, some cover that was kind of in that class. Like it almost feels like it's of that Tom Wolfe, you know, kind of novel era.
Right. And there was a great cover actually that I had sent the designer that I liked of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, where there's a fabulous 70s font.
Yep.
And maybe that was part of the reason she was inspired to use this. I don't know. The other thing for me is that in addition to wanting the title not to be so small that it would cause the book somehow to disappear, I also was terrified of being misleading. This is not a book about my father. This is a book about a girl coming of age.
Right.
So I really didn't want my father's picture on the cover.
Right.
And I also, I guess in retrospect, it might not have been a great idea to have Helvetica Sands on the cover, because that might have also seemed as if it was borrowing from him.
Right.
So that was really important to me. And then also, in terms of representing the book correctly, to not have it be sad.
Right.
I think some people are taking sadness from it, or they're taking, some people said, I'm laughing, am I supposed to? And I'm like, yes, please, laugh. It's supposed to be funny. I think that it was important that there was a certain playfulness. And you know, there always is. Really good design is so playful. Mm. That's what I love about it. It's so fresh.
How much of a battle was that to keep your dad's face off the cover with the publisher? Because I'm sure they were just like, why don't you just call it, you know, Steve's daughter?
You know? I know, the Steve Jobs daughter story. Right. But daughter and story are really tiny. They were amazing, actually. My publisher has been amazing. And I switched publishers later in the process. I switched from a larger publisher to a smaller independent publisher, partially for that reason. But to be honest, even the larger publisher had been quite clear when they bought the book that it was going to be a literary memoir. And I had control in both cases. I had final say in both cases over the cover.
Right.
But there's a tricky thing that happens. And I wonder if you've experienced this or even perhaps been on the other side of this. But I think it must be frustrating if you're working with someone creative and you have some idea of time and they don't. And you have no control over their process. And one of the ways I think that business interacts with creatives is that they sort of run out the clock. Mm. So they'll say, you know, we'll just do a few covers and then we'll get them back to you. And if they don't work, then we'll find a new designer and we'll redesign it.
Right.
And having worked on the book for what I'm saying was 7 years, but I'm sure it was more than that, I had become savvy to the ways of the publishers a little bit. And in this case, I thought, no, what might happen in that case is that we run out of time.
Right.
And literary people, especially these incredible publishers that I have, you know, their field is not designed, so that perhaps they don't think of it as taking so much time.
Mm.
And then what I worried might happen is if we didn't find the right designer right away, we might try to find a good designer at the last minute and then tell that good designer to work quickly, which doesn't work well.
Right. And then also, I mean, there's a disconnect between the amount of time spent on the manuscript and then the amount of time spent on the container for it. And that doesn't feel right either.
Well, and that's always going to be true, I think, in this case, because they couldn't spend 7 years on the cover.
Well, you don't want to spend 7 years, but you also don't want to like just at the last second kind of be like, wow, well, we're out of time. Let's just, okay, we're going to throw this person on it. Like that's not healthy either.
Well, it's similar to the way we were talking about reviews, I guess.
Yeah.
Like books are so time consuming to write often. And it's such an incredible process that the idea of being hard on a writer, of writing a scathing review of a writer is just, it's so problematic. Why wouldn't you just turn away? And I do agree with you about a cover. After all this work, the writer should be happy with their cover. And design is often, you don't know why you're happy, but you know when you are.
Yeah. Well, there has to be a balance because, I mean, you're rare in that you have good taste. So like that's like you're one of these rare people that, I mean, you have a background in design.
I hope so, but I never could have designed a cover. And I certainly did not tell the designer. I mean, I think you might tell me something was wrong with a scene in my book, but you wouldn't necessarily know how to fix it.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes that mistake is even made with writers where people say, maybe you could do this and this and this and that would fix it. And I guess occasionally that could work, but the rule I've often gone by is if someone notices something wrong, they're almost always right that something is wrong, but their way of fixing it probably isn't. So to listen to the problem, but really not, but you have to find the solution for your own work yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that similarly with designers, it can be tempting to say, well, what about you try this or what about, but before the design is, I mean, obviously that can work with spacing in between letters, but before the design is fleshed out, it's really just a conversation, I think, of what you find the good designer, and then it's a conversation of what is the book about? What does it mean? And then it's their job to translate meaning into visual imagery.
Hmm.
So I didn't, ever present any ideas. The one thing that I did talk to her about is I think her original designs were a bit negative.
Okay. Right.
And I wanted a more balanced and positive interpretation to be on the cover because that's how I feel about the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I did tell her that, you know, too negative.
I mean, I think that that kind of direction is really important. And I think like what I was saying earlier, just about like, you know, writers having taste around the sense of like what's going to work in a market or not work in a market.
But they don't know what works.
Exactly. A lot of people don't. But the I think just your point about time is really important because that's what to find that place where both the publisher who ostensibly has some insight into kind of like how to position a certain thing in the market to get the most sort of traction and have the widest audience and in a positive way. And finding the balance between the cover that achieves that. And then also the one that, yeah, the author is pleased with. I think that's where the time component, I think that's where you're really smart to push for things not to be held off until the last minute.
But again, I'm not sure if we know how design really relates with market appeal. People do gravitate toward beauty.
Yeah.
And you can't ever sell people short on their taste. Sometimes they don't get the pretty thing maybe because it's too expensive or because they can't find something they actually like. But in general, I think sometimes this idea of marketability is fashioned and isn't researched and isn't necessarily true. And then another thing is sometimes a book is so good that it doesn't really matter what the cover is. And maybe then they think it was the cover that did it, but actually it was the book. And I think
just to that point, like Ferrante's,
right.
True. Like those covers, I haven't read those books because of the covers.
Because you can't stand the covers. And so you don't read the books.
Well, just like those books have been recommended to me so many times and they're a little bit outside of my normal reading universe and,
fiction women.
No. I read lots of fiction, lots of female fiction writers. I'm just finishing right now. Asymmetry, actually. It's by Lisa Halliday.
Oh yeah. I've heard that's great.
It's so totally blowing me away.
I keep on hearing that one's great.
It's so good. And that's got a gorgeous cover, this beautiful folded paper airplane sort of cover going on. And then also Crudo by Olivia Lang, Lynn Tillman's latest novel.
So what is it about the Ferrante book that seems, I'm pronouncing it in my Italian way, the Ferrante, that seems outside of your reading universe?
I don't read novels of story very often. I read mostly novels of ideas, I guess. And so the female part of it is none of that is a turnoff. It just feels like it's like I look at it and go, okay, that's a novel of story. It just feels like intensely story driven. And
it is.
I haven't read any of the Harry Potter books either, which I should, I'm sure. But like it's just funny with the Ferrante novels in particular, the covers I think made me feel like they were intensely novels of story in a way that pushed me away from them.
It's true. They've leaned into their genre.
Yes.
So much.
But there's probably a bunch of people who did read it because of that cover that wouldn't have read it otherwise. So it's a weird process.
Right. So we definitely do judge books by their cover, but I'm still not sure the publishers understand all of the complicated calculations that go into that judgment. And so I think sometimes when they push people to do something for marketability, it can be a false certainty.
Yeah.
Just the way sometimes when they have people cut certain parts out of their book for marketability, it can also have a false certainty to it. But then sometimes they do know, I guess. So it's hard, it's really hard to know. And what I would try to do with my book is certainly the inside and what needed to be cut and what could stay is just to have a gut feeling with certain things. And there were certain things that my editor had said, I think you can let that go. And I couldn't. And then finally, when I read it over for the last time, and I was only allowed to make, you know, changes to 1% of the book or something like that. Finally, then I would say more than half of those sections, you know, there were only a few left, maybe four or five left. I thought, okay, now I can cut this. But it wasn't until I knew. And I felt the same about the cover that I in part had moved to a publishing house that's independent and had changed to a much lower book advance so that we could make decisions based on the book, not based on the quick marketability, because the marketability, of course, was always going to be based on my father.
Right.
And that would be tricky for all the people that were dearly hoping to pick up a book about Steve Jobs and were going to end up reading about a young girl.
Right.
I felt especially worried about that in the beginning.
Right.
Now
right.
I feel less worried. Now I feel like, oh, I'll trick them and then they'll be happy and they won't know why. But in the beginning, I thought they would just be so terribly disappointed. And so I had to save my book from false disappointment. And the way I had to do that was somehow show some degree of joy and show a girl.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was hoping for. In the beginning, the covers she had produced, there was a girl spinning in the darkness. And the girl seemed too pretty, certainly prettier than I was or am, but also kind of pretty in a way that somehow didn't seem like a child. But I like the way that she did the flowers.
Yeah.
They feel at the same time sweet and reaching and longing and also sinister.
There's something very melancholy about it.
Do you think?
Because again, it's this vibration between two spaces here that's going on. You feel the kind of youthfulness, the youngness of this silhouette of the girl. And it's funny the way the flowers are placed. It almost looks like she's holding them.
It does, doesn't it? And holding them out almost.
Yes, holding them out. And there's a quietness there that could almost be on her own in a field somewhere, or in some ways a little bit like a funeral.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, because there are chrysanthemums as well.
Yeah.
Aren't there chrysanthemums, or are there just, maybe there aren't. Oh, there are anemones and poppies.
Okay.
And I think anemones might have something to do with death. I'm not sure. But there's certainly a more bold and dramatic flower. And then the leaves of the poppies look a bit like veins.
Oh, they totally do. It all connects so well with the book. I mean, like your big trick with this book was you're like, you didn't want people to get a false expectation for what the book was about. But it almost didn't matter because you pulled that dirty trick of writing well.
I know. Ha ha. Thank you.
You know, it's like when you have a great professor, it doesn't really matter what the topic is. You want to follow that person into the deepest folds of their minds about the
right.
stuff they're
it
interested in.
It certainly doesn't matter what they're wearing.
Right. Right. Mm. I just feel like, and a big part of the book is obviously coming of age. And it's, you know, there is this kind of mourning for, again, this vibration between being part of a family or not part of a family. Should I be elated? Should it be a party? Or should I be, again, mourning sort of like the loss of this connection? And it's a very hard act to pull off, but I feel like this cover hits all the notes. It gets the time right. I mean, in terms of when a lot of the book takes
right.
place.
California, 70s.
Totally.
80s.
Totally. It just completely nails all that. It's really one of those rare, lovely covers that it feels as smart as the book.
Oh,
that it's
thank
covering.
You so much. Thank you so much. Oh my God, Allison will be so thrilled about that. She really did so well by me. She just kind of had an idea and went with it, and it was great. And she also wanted to do the rough paper. And I, for some reason, got worried that it would be too expensive.
Huh, okay.
That it would be too expensive and lavish. And that the other problem sometimes with that, I'm forgetting what it's called, what the stock is called. It's very matte. And then one of the problems can be that it becomes dirty quite easily.
Right. Yep.
And that the stickers, the sort of just like author signed stickers won't come off.
Right.
So, you know, the whole reason I presumably you're getting something signed by the author is that it has some value, a value which is completely ruined by the sticker that won't pick off the front of your book.
Right.
So I was worried about that. But she was right that the texture, especially if you have so much white space, the texture becomes important.
Mm.
And I feel so grateful that they were willing to pay for this significantly pricier kind of paper.
Right.
The truth is, I don't know how much pricier it is, but I think it's pricey.
Yeah.
The publisher also went to the printers and sat there and made sure they got it right. The colors and the alignment. I don't know if they always do that with hardbacks, but I was very moved that they were willing to do that.
You know, the paper of a cover, I think, is hugely, hugely, hugely important. It is the thing that gives you an emotional connection to the object, right? It's the thing that you feel when you're searching for it in your bag. It's the thing that your fingertips are against the entire time you're reading it and you're holding it.
It's true. I didn't think about it that way, but you're right. I mean, I talk about Franny and Zoe in the book. And you know that Franny and Zoe copy, that edition that is that matte paper that has just a few lines?
Mm.
I don't know if you had that copy, but I think they still have it in the bookstores now. And it's true that I have a relationship with it also through touch.
Mm.
That the haptic Just like smell, it's underestimated, I think, in how powerful it is.
Oh, totally.
And sound. I sometimes wonder if we like people and have a feeling of closeness with people sometimes because of their voices.
Yeah.
We often think it's the way they look, but maybe it's also their voice. But anyway, maybe it's the way their skin feels. Who knows?
Right. Well, that, I'm sure that helps.
That's another podcast.
But you're perceptive about the dirt thing, because it's true. It, like, the cover will get more dirty if it's not glossy, if it's not.
Oh, it's totally neurotic. I went to the bookstore like 4 times. But did they get dirty? But what do you think? But which paper should I use? What about the stickers? But I made them promise not to put the just signed stickers on my book. So
yeah.
They put a sign. So, you know, because.
Well, But that's all important, because like that, if this is why publishers are reticent to do things like this, because if a book has like the smallest smudge on it, people won't buy it, and they'll get it sent back, and you know, it'll be a return.
I know. Apparently the publishing industry has not negotiated terribly well for themselves.
No.
They take their books back.
Yes.
I think they might just want to say, you buy it, you keep it.
Well, that's what I did for many years. I played by the rules, and then eventually I said, okay, any new books I produce, or that I'm publishing or producing, they're going to be sold 90% online, because that's fine. And then they're going to be sold in a select number of small bookshops that I love. And with those small bookshops, basically, I just said, look, I can't follow up on invoicing, you know, every 6 months or whatever. Like, so you just have to buy them. I'm sorry. Like, you can buy a small number, but you just have to buy them up front. Man, that removes a lot of stress of bookselling.
Yeah. And it is funny how picky you have to be to get things right.
Yeah.
How much you have to decide what things you're going to follow and what things you're not going to follow and what rules.
Oh, yeah.
See, I had a baby right before the book tour.
Right.
It's been wonderful, actually. The whole thing has been wonderful. But one thing that was frustrating was that I felt I was having to push back a lot.
Mm.
When that energy of pushing back was exactly what I didn't have.
Hmm. What do you mean push back against publisher?
There was an article in a magazine that came out originally from the book, and the magazine sort of wanted to put in something that wasn't right. And so I had to try to find a compromise with them. And then I compromised with them, and they took my compromise and then put in the rest of what they wanted. I said, no, you can't take the concession. And then,
yeah.
So it was kind of having to be a little bit of a fighter. And even, you know, worrying about the spacing in between the letters of the title made me feel like a diva and a fighter and all the wrong things in a certain way. The reason I was fighting was that I felt like, and I'm sure other authors have felt this way, that it wasn't about me anymore, that I had worked for a very long time on this book.
Right.
And then I had to make sure it had the best life that it could have, that the people that needed and wanted and would enjoy reading it, it would somehow find their way to them.
Mm.
And it would be represented as much as possible in an accurate way. And it was a kind of lesson in the way the world works, because I published an excerpt that was already chopped up. And that excerpt was then excerpted into little pieces of things that didn't mean anything.
Right.
So part of the reason the cover had to be as close as possible to write for the book and for who I am is that every element had a lot of heavy lifting to do. There were already going to be a lot of ideas about this book and about me that were going to be wrong, and I couldn't fight it in every place. And so in the places where I could insist for something that felt true to the book, I had to go overboard.
Right.
And the cover is an amazing place, right? Because you see it and you don't see anything that leads you to believe this is going to be a hagiographic tell-all.
Right.
I hope. If
no,
you do, tell me.
No. It's like I said, I think it's very, very true to the content in a way that, you know, is not always the case with a lot of covers. And it's not being stylish for the sake of being stylish. It's not being poppy for the sake of being poppy. Like, everything works on that cover in a way that feels very satisfying.
I guess that's what I worried about with the font, is if it was too poppy.
No, I mean, it's of that moment.
But it seems to work.
Yeah,
it's of the moment.
California in the 70s and 80s. I mean, it'd be weird if you'd put like a medieval script, like if it was like something like a illuminated manuscript or something like that. That would be pretty strange.
But like, think about this. So I read a long time ago, I read Paul Rand. I actually saw Paul Rand speak the last time that he spoke publicly. I saw him at MIT. And then he died, I think, a month or two after that. He didn't seem ill. He seemed great. He was just giving a lecture about his career, and it was interesting, and I didn't know much about him. And he talked about how this idea of, like, you don't need a script that recalls China for the font of your Chinese restaurant.
Right.
That you don't need to use a font with timber logs on it for your Montana lodge. That you can simply use a beautiful font. You can have it be, I don't know if he was saying anachronistic, but you can, you don't need to have it blend or refer to another cliche. And really the great thing about design is looking at something with fresh eyes.
Yeah. Well, also I think what he's speaking to is having confidence in the thing itself. Like, the Chinese restaurant is going to impress upon you its Chinese-ness. You don't have to, like, you don't have to be like, hey, it's a Chinese restaurant. Like, people are going to understand that.
Right. And there's something cheesy and weak about having to overkill your theme with your font. So that's what I worried about with my sort of huge 70s font. I thought, like, it seems a little on the nose.
I guess so. But I mean, for people,
I'm like making you reassure me, but do you think it's fine?
For people, well, no. Lisa, I think we have to go back. Let's get the time machine. Let's get rid of this Hera foolishness.
Yeah, exactly.
No. I think for people who don't know, it's just evoking an emotion, right? And not in the same way like crazy Chinese font evokes like the sense of like otherness or China or whatever. But this is just evoking emotion in people. I think that's what's really important. For the most part, people are going to spend half a second looking at the cover.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
It's going to barely register in their vision, and it's going to either compel them to go, oh, well, you know, something is going on there that hit a note that's interesting to me, or they're going to just walk past it.
It is interesting how many things we encounter in our lives and which ones make a difference to us.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this with my son because I think what actually will interest him? I mean, he's going to have so much stimulation, and then what will pull him in one direction or another? Or like this idea of giving children opportunities. I'm not sure it's the opportunities that matter. It's creating receptivity in someone. My husband listened to this podcast, and there's a man who is now a famous chef. And when he was young, I think he was poor, and I think he was working in a restaurant in Queens, and it was really late at night, and one of his fellow restaurant workers noticed he was hungry and brought him a bowl of hot rice with a raw egg mixed in.
Right.
And for him, it was a revelation. He had never had anything like that. It was so delicious and so simple. And from that, he started his whole restaurant empire. I'm probably misquoting some part of this story, but this is what I remember.
Like, isn't this Ivan Ramen?
Probably.
I think it's Ivan.
I think it's Ivan Ramen. But from that story, I was thinking, so it wasn't the bowl of rice and egg, because you could have given that bowl of rice and egg to 100 people.
Yeah.
It was that he was ready for that bowl of egg and rice.
That was mind-blowing.
You know, so it's the same, I guess it's the same with, right. I guess it's the same with a cover. Like, it's not always the cover. It's just whether somehow, for some reason, this particular cover calls to you.
Yeah. Well, and also, it also is just like, have you been beaten over the head with the notion that you should get this thing yet or not?
And that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping people have been beaten over the head that they should get it.
You
and
must
that they
read
won't
this.
Even look at the cover. They'll feel like sort of just like numb and beholden to, and they'll just be like, I must buy. They'll feel like a robot.
Zombie
the
readers.
Other thing that Paul,
that's what
yeah,
you want.
Zombie readers. That's what I want. The other thing that Paul Rand said during that lecture, which I thought was kind of cool, was that if you have beautiful things, and I think he meant in your house, you know, when you say something like that, when I say something like that, it might imply expensive, and I don't mean expensive. I just mean, you know, well considered.
Yeah.
If you have beautiful things, he said, you don't need to worry about their compatibility because they will all go together.
Mm.
And I think about that a lot. Is he right? Was he right or was he wrong? Was he right or was he wrong? Because I'm not sure that's true, but that was his theory. But maybe he just meant, you know, mid-century furniture. Who knows?
Right. So to peel back a little bit more, the creation process of the book in general, I'm curious about a couple of things. For example, what was the first vignette that you wrote Because did you start working on this with your MFA, or was it before you started the MFA? What was the genesis moment for producing this book?
I did not think that I would do a memoir, or I desperately did not want to do a memoir while I was working on my MFA.
Okay.
But I did feel at a certain point, because of the steady drumbeat of due dates and essays that needed to be done, yes, that I might as well do an essay about what had happened around my birth.
Yeah.
And because of that, I actually had to go and get the court records. But I was living in England at the time. I was doing a non-residential MFA. So I started actually when I was in London and then moved to New York for the rest of it. So I had my mother go to the courthouse and get the documents. And then we got in a fight, I think because it was really stressful and kind of awful.
It's
and
like, hey, mom, I have this horrible wound I'd like you to open up.
And not only that, I have this horrible wound that I'd like you to help me with, and you're involved, and you were the one who was there.
Right, right.
So she was trying to fax me the papers, and I think that we were actually faxing papers. I think that that maybe is the most important or the most interesting part of this whole story. You're faxing papers? And she was getting them all out of order and missing pages. And then I was getting upset with her. And then she was yelling. But she very kindly did this favor for me. And then I found out that the dental records of this other man had been subpoenaed during this trial. And I found out that it hadn't been my mother that had sued. It was the state. And I was just trying to reconstruct what had happened in a very dry way so that I could understand it for myself. And it turned out to be very lucky that I had done that, because much later, after I had written a full draft of my book, I gave it to one of my friend and my mentor, Philip Lopate. And he said, Lisa, you just need to tell people, you do need to tell them sort of just what happened. You just need to give them the lay of the land. Obviously, the whole book doesn't need to be a sort of essay and exposition on the past before you were there, but you do need to tell them. And so I thought, perfect, I've got it. And I plopped it in. So that is the kind of mostly in one piece explanatory essay that gives me the permission, I think, to go more slowly in the rest of the book and to not worry so much about placing you in time and space as much as I'm concerned with placing you in my own emotional life, which is more fun and which is more delicate. So I had done that in my MFA, but I was definitely trying not to do a memoir because, oh, you know, how awful, the kid of a famous person doing a memoir, barf. And then how was that going to be received? And also, how was I going to have the ability to make something that would merit existing, that wouldn't just fit into this celebrity memoir category? And then even if I had the ability, who would ever see it that way? And then I think in some ways, all those questions were a cover for a deeper fear, which was, I feel quite ashamed about certain things. And will I have to feel those feelings again? Because I don't want to, you know, I'd like to get through them. Is there a way to get through them without understanding them or feeling them? The answer, probably no. So I thought perhaps I would do another nonfiction book first, but I just couldn't seem to find something that was drawing me to it. And so I didn't commit to writing the memoir until after the MFA. And what I started with were a few scenes. Actually, I didn't really understand how to write scenes because I've been writing essays up to that point, which can be much more dense and much more expository than you could be in a book of this length. It would get very heavy very fast to do this book in an essay form. And also, it's not the convention. The convention right now for a memoir is to write it in scenes. And I do understand that. It gives the reader a feeling that they're there and they get to parse out the details and they get to decide what things mean. And it feels more free and it feels more delightful, I think, as a reader to read that kind. But anyway, I didn't know how to write a scene. And so I started out, I think the first one I wrote was that time my mother and I went and took a couch from my father's house when he wasn't there.
Yeah, where you like broke in basically.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the tricky parts about the book was that when I started writing these scenes, I wasn't really in them. My editor would read them and she would say, it's good. I can sort of see who your parents were, but where are you? Like, I don't even know where to place you in the room. I don't even know what you're thinking. I don't know. And I didn't know what to do with that problem. I felt embarrassed to use the word I too much because I thought, oh God, I'm mortifying. I. But I guess that was also telling, right? Like if you're writing a memoir and you're worried about the word I,
right.
Maybe you haven't gotten over your problems yet. After a while, I felt like I had to kind of explore the more devious sides of myself. Any situation where I'd done something maybe I shouldn't have done or felt in a way I shouldn't have felt. And when I started exploring those scenes, that's when I started appearing on the pages.
Right.
But I think even now that scene where me and my mom go and get that couch, I like it. But I haven't really read it at readings and I haven't really thought it was a standalone piece so much because actually I'm not as a character fully there. Mm. So that's how you can tell it's one of the first ones I wrote.
Interesting.
And okay. It didn't change very much.
Yeah. I think that's a very common pattern when writing about your history in a weird way. Writing yourself out of it is a common technique, I think, because touching those emotional, like high intensity wires, again, going back to those places can be scary. I think one of the things that's really interesting about your book is that you do get there. So even if some of those early scenes, you feel like you weren't there, it feels like a extremely emotionally vulnerable story, genesis.
It's funny though, because now that it's written,
yeah.
Now that all my embarrassing stories are out there, I feel less vulnerable than I've ever felt. So it's almost like when they're inside you, when there's a drop down and you don't know when it's going to fall and you don't know what it means, it's harder. Now that it's out there, I think, well, I guess I'm human. I guess this is humanity.
Well, you've been extremely lucky too. I mean, like we were saying, you don't know how books are going to do.
Oh my God, I've been so lucky. It's so much luck.
You can pour a decade of your life into something and like six people see it.
I know. And it can be so good.
It can be so good. Six people see it. And then maybe if you get one review and the review is sort of like, ugh, you know, just dismisses it or something like that is totally, completely a potential sort of outcome for spending an insane amount of time and pouring your heart and blood and soul and everything into a book.
Right. And the way that I think about that sometimes, if that happens, is the positive aspect of that could be you don't actually know how much you can change the world or how much you have changed the world or how much you have delighted someone or what impact that has, or even, you know, the right book to the right person at the right time can change generations.
Mm.
Even if it seems small, it might not be. But yeah, right. I know, man. God.
It's so terrifying.
It can be so terrifying that you can express yourself so painstakingly and that it wouldn't even get out there.
Well, and also like you can be so insanely vulnerable and like you're putting your beating heart basically you're putting it on the world stage and like you're saying, hey, if anyone wants to come over here, I have a pile of axes. Like if you want to chop up my beating vulnerable heart, like come on. And then like, of course, that's what, you know, happens to a lot of things. And so I think watching your book kind of go from those excerpts where, you know, obviously the tech world kind of looks at it and goes, hey, you know, oh, what's this? Oh, this story about Jobs and Bono and, you know, and like the provenance of the Lisa name for the computer and things like that. Going from that to getting the, you know, thoughtful reviews to getting now in the last, you know, we're at the end of 2018 now. And in the last month or so, we're ending up on all these best of like top 10 lists.
I know. I can't even believe it. I haven't read any of the reviews, by the way.
Right.
I haven't read a single review.
That's very smart.
And my husband has been great. He'll sometimes read me snippets.
Yeah.
Or he'll say, oh, it was a good review for the book, but I don't think you'd like the way they took it.
Right.
I didn't want to read the reviews at all because I just had a baby and the idea of going on some roller coaster didn't sound good. I don't like roller coasters anyway. I have a responsibility to keep my equanimity.
Yeah.
And I think that some of the reviews have been quite positive, but if I were to read them, I would hit the roof because they are drawing conclusions about my life from my book that they find unassailable that are not my conclusions.
Right. Well, and also we're programmed in such a way as, especially when it comes to things like this, where it is us as much as it can be us, you know, on the page, we are programmed to ignore all of the positive and pick up on the one billionth of a millimeter of negative.
Why is that? Why could that programming be advantageous? It doesn't feel, I know. Why is that?
Because we're all broken. That's why. Because we're all suffering from imposter syndrome. We're all worried we're going to be caught at any moment, and you know, the curtain's going to be lifted and we're going to be revealed for the frauds that we are.
Actually, this whole process, it's felt like it's happening to someone else. Right. And sometimes I think it'd be nice if I could be more receptive to the good things. I'm not exactly sure how to take them. It feels very detached, but I feel happy for the book. Yep. And I feel actually relieved because I didn't really fully consider what it might be like to be savaged when I also had a little baby. I think I would have just ignored it just as I did, and we would have just ignored it all the more.
Right.
But that would have been really hard. With any large creative project, there is so much terror along the way. And it's so gut-wrenching. And if it's not, maybe it's not working. At least that's from my very limited experience.
I mean, I think what you're describing is like the need for tension, right? It's like in Japan, they have this phrase called hewa boke, which is basically you've been beaten into a lull by peace. Like things are too peaceful. And so a lot of the post-war generation...
Complacency.
Yes, there's the complacency that comes with peace. And a lot of the, you know, the post-war generation parents and things were kind of complaining that their kids were all hewa boke. Like, you guys don't have the, like, we had to like scrounge for rice.
Fire in your belly.
Yeah, or the fire in your city, you know, to motivate you.
Right.
And so I think there's totally a truth to that.
We spend our lives so much just trying to get comfortable.
Hmm.
And I think that's the last thing that matters to the soul. Like on your deathbed, the last thing you might say is, maybe I didn't love or I didn't work, but I was comfortable. I don't think you'd say that. I think what you want to know on your deathbed is nothing about comfort.
Right.
It's something like, did I love the people I loved? Did I really love the people I loved? And did I do the work that I felt meant to do?
Yeah.
Not someone else's work, but my work. And those two things don't have anything to do with sheet thread count or how comfortable you are or how big your house is or anything.
Right.
And so it's so strange that these things are at odds.
Right. Well, and comfort is sort of you could think of a definition of it as being avoiding anxiety. You know, I think we spend so much time avoiding things that will make us anxious or avoiding stressful situations. And I think part of why this book feels so powerful, and I think it's resonated in the way it's resonated, is that this whole book is a big leaning into anxiety.
I know, but it was like, if I didn't lean in, I wasn't going to get out. And so I had to go all the way in, and it was, sometimes I didn't know if I would ever get out.
Yeah, man, you feel that, you know? So like for me, one of the most powerful things about the book was getting in the head of a young girl in a way that I realized, I guess I'd never had that framing before. Obviously I wasn't a young girl, but you know, I have lots of friends with daughters, and I'm, you know, I kind of play a role in a lot of their lives as like uncles and, you know, godfathers and things like that. And it was just so powerful to read these details that I guess stood out that I wouldn't have expected, and that in your revealing of them made me realize that, oh my God, like this is from a very vulnerable place. Like you had this moment where Steve gave you some attention or something, and you said, my heart beat like a bird's heart, quick and light in my chest. It was what I wanted. All his attention focused on me all at once. And then in another moment you write, how close are you supposed to be with your father? I wanted to collapse into him to be inseparable. And lines like that, moments like that, where I felt like I was learning something and I was experiencing something truly new in the best possible way that only a book can let you experience.
I was talking with my friend who's a father today, with Philip Lopate, actually. We had a coffee and he was saying, we were talking about fathers and daughters. And I think I have the sense that, like many people have a sense that I'm, you know, terribly unique with my father-daughter relationship. And it's unique in its unfulfilled aspects. But I think actually there's something at the core. I mean, I'm probably just repeating Freud and telling myself that I'm original. But I think that there is something at the core of the father-daughter relationship that is unfulfilled. It's hard to find another person who can love you so dearly and so completely in that way. And then you have to grow up yourself. And you have to go find your own people. I don't think it's just me. It must not be just me, this feeling of, it's not enough. It's not enough. It gets so close to being just so incredibly right, and then it falls away again.
Yeah.
And of course, this is a more dramatic version of that in some ways, but in some ways it's not.
the stuff with Steve and Steve being who he was interesting just in the sense of there's only one person in the world that could write about him from that point of view, which you had. But the more general qualities of that connection, I think, were incredibly universal. And I think people struggle with this even in families where the father is living with them.
But this is what I'm saying. I think people struggle with this even where the father's relationship with the children is quite good.
Right. Totally. Totally.
Where it gets close, but is never, it cannot be fully completed.
Yep.
Because it doesn't have forward motion to it. So you have to kind of, I mean, my mother says, she used to say when I was complaining about my childhood, no one survives childhood. They just grow up.
Right.
And then there's another phrase about artistic projects, which is no project or no artistic work is ever finished. It's just abandoned.
Right.
And I guess there is this quality of out of your childhood, you don't tie it up into a bow. It's not complete. There's always this longing or existential gap.
Yeah. Well, there's always more work to be done.
Right. Otherwise, why be alive? I mean, it's so frustrating, all this work, right? Because again, we want to be comfortable and be done with the work, but that's death.
Right.
So, but still I find myself now that this book is done thinking, oh God, it's done, you know, and I want to just cozy up here forever. But
right.
At some point, it'll be important to get uncomfortable again.
Yeah. Well, for me, reading this, it was an emotional experience for a lot of reasons, but it was also a weirdly physical experience. So like, you know, the book opens with you stealing stuff, like, you know, grabbing a lipstick and things like that. And the reality is I was literally two blocks away from you when you were doing that.
Oh, what?
So I was living on Santa Rita.
You were living on Santa Rita?
Yes. I was living on Santa Rita, two blocks from that Waverly corner. And I moved there in 2010 to work with Flipboard, and I ended up living there two blocks from that house for 3 years. And Steve passed away right in the middle of when I was living there, about a year after I moved there. And I would walk, you know, I was walking by that house all the time. I walked by the house on the way to work.
You're like, and who is that strange girl nicking things?
I was like, that woman looks like she would be stealing stuff. But so to read, it was so surreal for me to read this because
you felt yourself in the place.
Well, I felt myself there, but also it was like, it was unpeeling this, all these questions I had for 3 years of like, I wonder what's going on.
What's happening in that house?
Because it was, you know, it really is this weird, unassuming, like Hobbit's house on the corner.
Oh, it's so beautiful, that house.
It's so cool. But it's also like, it's not a crazy giant mansion with like machine guns and lasers outside either. It's just there.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah.
It's just there. And so that adds more to the mystery to it. You're just kind of like walking by going, what's really happening in there? It's just like, you know, just this very strange, surreal sense of living in, you know, in that old Palo Alto area. It was all like Larry and Sergey from Google live there, and Paul Graham is there. And it was just
this
weird.
So funny, because when I was living there, not visiting, but living.
Yeah.
There was no Google.
Right.
I don't know who the, you know, so all those people weren't living there.
Right. But it's like, now it's like, it's basically like Disneyland, of startup Disneyland or something.
I know. I feel like the Palo Alto City Council maybe was a little behind on setting up regulations.
Maybe.
Because part of the beauty of the town was all these wonderful, fairly small houses that were all different from each other.
Yes.
And to let people tear them down to build compounds.
Yeah.
It perhaps was a mistake and cannot be rectified now.
Yeah. Well, I moved there totally by chance, knowing nothing. And it just so happened, like, a couple of friends of mine found a house that at that time in 2010 was still not that expensive. I mean, we were paying, you know, there's three of us. We paid less than $1,000 each for rent there.
Wow.
Which is insane to think now. And and it just so happened to be in the middle of all that. I kind of fell backwards into a really beautiful grove. I mean, old Palo Alto is gorgeous. So as I'm reading the book, I can picture kind of all of this. And then also even like the hills and those drives, like there's this moment where you and your father are driving in his Porsche in the hills up like near, you know, behind Sand Hill Road and up in Woodside. And
it's
like
so beautiful there, isn't it?
I have ridden in the same model Porsche up in those hills. So there was
I mean, you haven't been in those hills unless you've been in that Porsche.
Right.
No,
you need that. You need that old Porsche. It's not real. But no, there's just this weird synchronicity of the reading experience and my own experience. And then also I'm adopted. And so what was fascinating.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And what was fascinating about reading this was just how so much of your book was about the lines of who is in or out of family.
Yeah.
You know, who's, when are you allowed in? And,
yeah.
And how much of a struggle that can be, even with the blood connection, you know, and also in a weird way, how the blood like justifies it. I mean, there are these moments where, you know, where Steve would say things about you, just like, you know, about your DNA, the DNA connection, the pride in the DNA connection. And
then other times that he didn't believe in genetics.
Right. Right.
There was definitely a tussle there.
Yeah.
Because he would come out quite stridently on both sides. And then even after we were connected definitively, pretty definitively, I guess,
right,
the most definitively we could be at the time with the DNA test. And even after, he'd noticed that we looked similar.
Right.
Still, there was a way he was pushing me away.
Yeah.
And I was desperately trying to be comfortable in a place of belonging.
Yeah.
And then if I can't belong there, can I belong because I construct my own story so much and understand my own story so well that I don't feel like I can at least be pushed out of that? And I felt like the deeper I got into my own story, the more it became universal in the sense that it had the kind of arc that stories have, beginning, middles, ends,
right,
searching, no resolution, resolution. But I think the only resolution to the question of belonging is that in order to get this book to a place where it felt like I was honest, I felt more comfortable in my own skin. And so in that sense, it didn't matter if I was pushed out of some other group because I felt okay with who I was. That was the search, right? That's what was the impetus for this book, was to not feel so badly anymore.
Yeah.
And everything was worth that. All yeah. public vulnerability,
yeah.
all shameful moments. That does make you question belonging and think about how powerful that is.
Oh, it's so scary how powerful it is. And I think, you know, this book, in your vulnerability and your going to that place and asking these questions and creating that arc, you know, it gives, I think, a lot of other people permission to explore that.
Yeah. You know, books make you feel sometimes less lonely in your loneliness.
Yeah.
They don't eradicate the loneliness and they don't make it go away, but they change its tenor.
Yeah.
And of course, I hope to change the tenor of some people's feelings about themselves because I changed my own, I guess.
I think that's true. I think, you know, your father's celebrity, you shifted it from cliche to huge asset in this book. I think because...
Oh, that's nice. That's a compliment. Thank you.
Yeah, no, because I mean, like you said, the worry is that it becomes cliche, right?
Right.
And I think what happened in this book, because the story was not about that, it wasn't about, like, you know, his work or whatever, it was about that relationship, and it was about the complexity and the conflict of that relationship. And I think the reason the celebrity was an asset is because the outward persona of that person was so confident and so knowing, you know, just, I know what this thing has to do. I know how this has to work. I know how this should be designed. And then to see.
And so often right.
Absolutely right. But I think what's often missed in that narrative is the messiness of getting to that rightness. But because the persona is so strongly confident, that to see someone like that struggle with something so fundamental as being present for his daughter,
right,
was hopeful in a way, I think, because it makes you realize that even the people who seem to have the strongest sense, right, of movement in the world, still, this is so messy. It is so emotionally messy.
Yeah.
And like you just said, like, not knowing is okay. You know, not knowing if, how do I be a dad? You know, how do I take my daughter roller skating? Like, what am I supposed to say to her? Am I supposed to, you know, should I be making out with my girlfriend in front of her? Like,
it was so valuable to do this book for things like that. There were revelations for things like that, because when I looked back without really thinking about it, there were a lot of long, awkward silences, and maybe I had thought as a girl that he didn't want to talk to me, and maybe I thought as an adult that he didn't care to talk to me or didn't like to talk. And it wasn't until I spent the time thinking about it that I realized he was younger than I am now, and he might not have known how to talk to a kid.
Totally.
That he was awkward.
Totally.
And that he was ambivalent, and that ambivalence didn't really have anything to do with me and might have had to do with him. And so then I'm looking at another person with much more compassion.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get to have a new relationship with my father and with myself as a girl. And if you change your perspective of your own past, your future changes in some ways.
Yeah.
And I think there were a bunch of places where I had assumed I know what something meant. And it had become fixed in my mind, maybe even from my childhood perspective. And it was only digging under the skin of it with the perspective of an adult that I was able to realize that many of the things I had understood were just incorrect, that there was more confusion and not knowing in the situation than you imagine when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And the confusion doesn't hurt so much. It's intriguing and it makes you curious. If someone is malicious, you feel badly. If someone doesn't want you, you feel badly. But if they don't know what they're doing and they're trying, it changes your perspective of them.
Yeah.
And it has been interesting from what I've heard. You know, she doesn't understand she's in an abusive situation, or she doesn't understand her own story.
Right.
And I think that's probably true for parts. But one thing I've wanted to say was, no, I'm the person that wrote the scenes that made you feel that way. Like, I might not be telling you what to think, but I'm the one who's making you feel. So don't think I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
I put those scenes in. There were many scenes.
Yeah.
And I chose those.
Yeah. Well, to tie it back to the cover, the feeling that I got reading this, and maybe my perspective is unique because, you know, like I said, I am adopted. I don't know any of my blood family. I don't know, you know, I've never known genetic connection to someone. And so I lean very heavily on this idea of fluidity and family and how friends can be absolutely folded into family and that there is no difference in the end. And so reading this book left me with a sense of hope. It wasn't a dark book at all to me.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
It's a hopeful portrait of how hard it is. It's so freaking hard to believe in connections, even when they're explicit.
It can be perilous. And people are trying to protect themselves from such dangers.
And paralyzing. Sometimes. You know, it's like you don't, sometimes you just, you stop moving, you know, and I understand the perspective of like, this is an abusive relationship. It's both true that a relationship can be abusive inadvertently in some ways, and also just the nature of the human condition, which is to be in this state of unknowing. You know, it's like, it's like we're so hungry for black and white concrete answers.
And that complexity doesn't stop connection.
No, no. And connection is not either an on or off switch. It's not binary, you know, and there's insane, crazy, heart-wrenching gradients of connection. And, you know, over the course of your life, it's going to wax and wane between all different people. It's constantly modulating.
Mm-hmm.
I think I also felt your catharsis in having produced this artifact, which I don't know if is true or not. When I finished the book, I thought, okay, this was not only really important for me to read for a bunch of reasons, but like this was clearly super important for Lisa to write.
It was so important.
And you feel that.
It had jewels all along the way. And then I hope it will be a book that I'm happy with in 10 years and in 20 years.
Right,
obviously, you would write a different memoir at different decades of your life. I'm so glad I didn't publish the one I would have written in my 20s. You know,
totally,
I'm like,
whoa. Absolutely, yes.
And it took me a decade to be the person I needed to be to finish this one.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of grow up while I was writing because the perspective of the woman who started writing this book wouldn't have worked. But it was cathartic because there were so many realizations and revelations and new understandings that cast different light on my story, and also just fitting your own story into the arc of traditional narrative is incredible.
Yeah.
Because maybe also you find you belong there, or you find connection there, that you're part of this. There must be something about story that is deeper and more hardwired.
Oh, totally.
That a story, if you get really honest about it, starts to look more universal. And there's something consoling and comforting about belonging to humanity in that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's comforting in an existential way, not just in a personal way, that you're not so alone in your most alone moments.
Yeah. I've experienced this as well, where it's someone who was part of your life passes away. And you maybe have a bunch of unresolved stuff with that person, and you write about it. In doing so, you unlock this whole new conversation. And then the cruel irony of it is that after having completed that writing,
They're not there to talk about it.
And you're like, oh my God, if only I could have been here when they were still around. The things I would have talked to them about.
I did have a few moments of that before my father died, because I'd already started thinking about certain things.
Yeah.
And it was helpful to whatever extent I'd started thinking, it was actually helpful. I thought, oh, that changes it. I see him slightly differently and better. And so we can talk a little more. And he seemed to respond to it well.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, I think, oh, that would be fun if we could talk about what I think I learned, and you could tell me where I'm totally wrong and where I'm not from your perspective.
Yeah.
But mostly now, because I have a baby, I think, oh, you missed out. Darn.
Right.
You would have liked this part.
Right. Well, I think the cover, the type, the girl with the flowers. I mean, the flowers appear a bunch, obviously, flower children and things like that. But also your couch and I think your chair both had like flowered.
That's true. The couch and the chair had flowers. The couch and the chair were more abstract flowers, which, as you can imagine, were more hideous.
Okay.
But were hideous.
These are beautiful.
It's another example of where it's connected to my book now, but the cover art was its own separate creative process.
Yep.
The flowers were not my invention.
Right.
But I like them. And the outline, my mother said, is that you? That must be you. I know that looks exactly like you when you were 12 or something. I said, Mom, that's not me. I think that's a stock outline of a girl.
Right.
I didn't wear knee socks. I would have liked to, but I didn't.
Well, it's just, you know, it just speaks to how much we project onto things, you know.
I know it does, right?
But the cover is connected to the innards of the book. I mean, as a whole package, it really is a truly satisfying and successful literary exploration of family and the complexities of it in life. And just how, as much as we want to think we know what we're doing, we don't. And that's right. And that's okay. And actually the process of getting to the place of knowing is messy. And and I feel like this book gives a lot of permission.
Thank you so much.
I'm really grateful that you pushed through, because I know there are always points in the genesis of a book where you're like, okay, I'm going to give up on this thing.
Yeah, like every day.
every morning.
I mean, you would know, you know.
Yeah, I mean, just what a gift.
Thank you so much.
And also what a cover. What a great cover.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks.
Hey. You still there? Thanks for listening. As always, the full transcript of this episode lives over on craigmod.com. This episode is kind of a special episode because it's the first episode I can say was sponsored by you. Those readers and listeners out there, part of my newly formed, as of 2019, Explorers Club. On Margins is funded and produced entirely by me, Craig Mod. If you enjoyed this episode and others and want to see more of this in the world, consider joining the Explorers Club. More info on craigmod.com/membership. If you don't have the means to support with membership, consider popping on over to iTunes and leaving a review. It would mean a lot to me. Also, a big thanks to our other sponsor today, Blood. not red blood cells. Beautiful may they be, colored by hemoglobin, transporting oxygen, nutrients, metabolic waste, body grunts, 5 million per microliter, pillow donuts when electron scanned, round, delicious looking little nubs filled to the brim with life, particulate, but without, oh, sorry, without nuclei, and therefore no, they have no DNA. And so when we speak of blood, B-L-O-O-D, of ties of blood, of being connected by blood, we are speaking of not red, but white blood cells. White, the sprinkle-covered jujubes of blood, well-formed nuclei, protectors of the body, carriers of our code. Thank you, white blood cells. Although sometimes you can make things a little more complicated than need be.